Tonight, we're looking at chapter 3 of Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering. And the title of the chapter is The Challenge to the Secular. And the main thing that he's doing in tonight's lesson is he's trying to challenge some of the arguments that have been made by secular worldviews, such as a naturalistic, atheistic worldview, that is basically arguing that an atheistic worldview is better, it's a better way of looking at suffering. So that an atheist would claim that their worldview is actually better, a better way of handling suffering because they don't have to answer some questions. For example, an atheist would argue, I don't have to deal with the problem of all the difficulties and evil and hardship in the world and try to reconcile that with the existence of a God, a good God. They would say, I don't have to worry about that because I don't believe in a God. Or they would say that in their worldview, when someone is in bereavement over someone who has died, they would say, well, there's really no need to fear death. There's really no need to sorrow for that person because death is the end of everything. It's the end of existence. There's no suffering in death. There's no pain in death. There's nothing in death. So we don't have to mourn for that person because they're not experiencing anything. And so they have these arguments about how they view suffering. And this chapter is really about trying to debunk some of those arguments and show how Christianity is better equipped to handle difficulty and suffering in the world than the atheistic worldview. And so he talks about the fact that when push comes to shove, when life hits reality, that secular philosophies of suffering really don't do a good job of helping their people in the midst of suffering. And so we're talking about in reality here. We're not talking about a philosophy classroom. We're talking about when you're lying in the hospital bed or when you find out that a loved one has terminal cancer or you just lost a loved one or you had everything invested in the stock market and the stock market crashed and now you have nothing. So this isn't in the philosophy classroom. This is in real life. And secular philosophies like naturalism or atheism, they really don't do a good job of helping people in those times. And what's interesting is that he gives several examples toward the beginning of the chapter. And the one that he uses primarily is the really tragic shooting that happened at Newtown, Connecticut. And he talks about how in the aftermath of that suffering, that even in one of the most secular regions of the whole country, Connecticut, by no stretch of the imagination could it be regarded as part of the Bible Belt, that every single one of the families who lost a child had a Christian or a religious funeral. Every single one. And everyone was speaking in terms of faith and religion and praying for the families. And even President Obama was speaking in terms of prayer for the families, for the victims. And so he's just pointing out that it's interesting that when something really traumatic happens, when something huge happens, enters into our lives, that our secular, atheistic, naturalistic philosophies don't hold up very well in those situations. And so in the real world, if you ask a person on the street, you just walk up to them and do interviews and say, hey, what do you think about God? Is there a God? Is there such a thing as absolute truth? Is there such a thing as absolute good and evil? And in our current generation, you would have your average person say, no, I don't think there's any absolute truth. I don't think there's a God. I don't think there's any absolute good and evil. But yet when it comes to actual real life sorrow and hardship, by default, many of these people who would say they adopt a naturalistic viewpoint default back into some sort of theistic worldview that there is a God and that we can pray to and find solace in difficult times. So in real life circumstances, in the real world, they oftentimes ignore the counsel of the atheistic or naturalistic philosophers. Instead, what they end up doing is they fall back on the more traditional and spiritual explanations for suffering. In the book, he gives an explanation from an author named Richard Schweder. And he argues that older, more spiritual and traditional approaches persist at a popular level underneath the dominant secular discourse. They exist as personal or communal counter-discourses to the official discourse of scientific explanation. What he means by that is, if you hear the talking people on the news or on dialogue shows arguing about philosophy or arguing about suffering, they'll say, here's what we believe, here's what we think. But in reality, a lot of the people on the ground who are actually going through the difficulties are saying the opposite and thinking the opposite of what those naturalistic philosophies are teaching. So when real life happens, they end up actually acting in accord counter to what the prevailing philosophy of our age says. So he asked the question then, where were the humanists? So in Newtown, Connecticut, or in the face of great tragedy, where do the humanists go? Where are they? Where are they to be found? And he says that in times of crisis, a lot of times the humanists or the secularists or the atheists, however you want to describe that, that they're often absent. You don't hear people, at least not very many, surely not a majority, you don't hear very many people in the wake of something like a Hurricane Katrina or a Newtown, Connecticut, or Hurricane Matthew that just happened here just a couple weeks back. You don't often hear purely atheistic solutions given. Most often, you hear more religious, pietistic, spiritual reasons given. You hear talk of prayer. You hear talk of coming together in compassion and forgiveness and love for one another, people binding together as community. And so the humanists, they're really absent. They're not there in times of crisis. A lot of times, instead, what you see is very clear and religious language, very clear religious and spiritual language, and it's not questioned. Now, if you were to give a spiritual or religious argument in a normal time, when everything's calm and peaceful and everything's going well, people are going to argue against that. They're going to say, don't bring religion into this sphere. That's not welcome here in this dialogue. But when crisis hits, you don't hear people crying about people saying, hey, let's pray, or let's call on God for help at this time. You're not going to hear people saying, you don't hear very much about the ACLU saying, you shouldn't say prayer, Mr. President, when in a time of crisis, right? They're not going to argue against that. In fact, for most people, it's welcome at that time. So in a time of crisis, that spiritual language is welcomed in times of tragedy and grief. One of the atheistic arguments, one of the secular arguments, is that the only real purpose of religion, of faiths, whether it be Christianity or Islam or Judaism, really the only purpose for these devout religions or faiths is really just to provide community in time of suffering. So the atheist would say, well, the real benefit of faith or religion in times of difficulty is not so much the faith part of it or the theology part of it, but it's really just the community that the church establishes. And Tim Keller in the book makes the argument that religion, Christianity, provides more than just community. It's not just community that helps us in times of grief and suffering. Because religion gives us more than community, it gives us explanations. It gives us understanding. It gives us explanations of life that make sense of suffering and pain and help us to find meaning in it. So religion or Christianity, it's not just about the fact that we gather together and we have a community to support one another. Surely that's part of it. And we should be doing that as Christians, but there's so much more to what faith gives us in times of grief and sorrow than just community. It also gives us understanding, doesn't it? It gives us truth. It gives us explanation. It gives us worldview for how this fits into our lives and has a purpose. So it gives us meaning, gives us an explanation for what this is all about. So theology is important. What you believe is important. What the scriptures teach is important. It's not just a community. It's also the truth that our faith brings. Secular humanism is incapable of providing either true community or a satisfying theology to help in times of suffering. So, you know, secularism, atheism is going to say we're better equipped to help in times of grief. But the problem is that secularism doesn't have a basis for which to provide community. It doesn't have a unifying principle, a unifying truth to provide community. So atheism lacks a coherent force that brings us together, a cohesive force, I should say, that makes people one and a part of a common goal. It also doesn't have a very good or a satisfying theology or explanation to help us understand suffering. He makes the argument that true community is only forged when people unify around something that is more important than their individual self-interests, to which all share a higher allegiance. So there's got to be something bigger than us, bigger than myself, to which I can claim allegiance to and which binds us together as people into a community. So he says that humanism suffers from the valorization, that means giving valor to or giving honor to the individual, and cannot sustain true community. See, that's what's happening in our current age. Our current age is not about community anymore. It's not about community. It's not about groups. It's about me. We live in a radically individualized age where everything is about me. And just as an example of that, if you pay attention, you'll see this everywhere. Just take notice as you're watching the news or as you're watching someone give an interview, even as you're watching a normal television show or a movie, just for even entertainment purposes, have your radar antenna up just a little bit to spot this philosophy of radical individualism, of I exist for me, for my freedom and my happiness. One of the ones that just sticks in my mind, because it was kind of so much in your face the way that it was presented, and he got a lot of heat for it too, was I remember several years back when, for those of you that follow basketball or the NBA, remember LeBron James when he left the Cleveland Cavaliers? He's a native of Ohio, native of Cleveland. He was drafted by his home city to play for them, one of the best players in the NBA. And then when his contract was up, he gives this huge interview televised on ESPN for everybody to see. This is the first time anybody's ever done this, to have a whole show dedicated to where are you going next. And so it was a big spectacle. And he says, I'm going to Miami because that's what's going to make me happy. That's what's best for me and my family. Nothing about team, nothing about community. It was about me. And everybody got all upset about it. You know, you're being disloyal and you're leaving your town, you're leaving your city, you're leaving this place that has given basically made your whole life into what it is. And they got upset about it. But really, if you understand the philosophy that governs our age, they really shouldn't have been surprised by it. Because that's really what everyone's driven by, is my own freedom, my own happiness. And so humanism suffers from this. It lifts up the individual, and so it has a hard time developing and sustaining true community where people bond together for a common purpose. So we ask the question, is atheism really a blessing, as they would argue? Is there any benefit into being an atheist when it comes to times of pain or suffering? Atheism claims a superiority in times of suffering, because it doesn't have to wrestle with questions of the goodness of God and the problem of evil. So they don't have to try to reconcile those things, because they really don't believe in evil, per se, as we would describe moral evil, and they don't believe in a God. They don't have to reconcile these things together because they don't believe in it. So atheism's response to suffering really fits very much within their philosophy that suffering has no meaning and is really an interruption to life story. Suffering has no purpose. It's really an interruption to things. So let's get rid of it. So in secularism, the only appropriate response is to look for a natural or a scientific solution for the cause and then just move on and try to make things better for the future. That's atheism's response. And so they offer consolation to the bereaved by trying to offer rational truths such as, well, that person doesn't exist anymore. And there's no suffering after death. So they just move on and they try to find a rational and scientific solution to the cause of their suffering. So secularism, atheism, naturalism is really kind of unique in terms of philosophy and the history of the world, because almost every other religion or philosophy or faith at least has a place for suffering in its story. It can teach you things. It can mold character. It can teach you patience. It can draw you closer to God. They at least have some meaning for suffering, but atheism, secularism doesn't. Secularism, pure naturalism, says that any suffering is really just an interruption in the middle of your life, and it's unwelcome, right? Because if we're all about the individual, and if our highest goal in life is my personal happiness and freedom, then how does suffering fit into that? It doesn't. There's no role for suffering if your ultimate goal is happiness. So they just try to move on. Let's try to get past it. Let's try to fix it. And let's try to fix it for the future so it doesn't affect us or anybody else again. So here's the problem, though. One of the problems with atheism's answers to these things is that atheism exaggerates the problem of evil. I put that in quotes. Atheism exaggerates the problem of evil. And we saw last week that this problem of evil really was not a problem before the rise of the immanent frame. That is radical individualism, where in the Enlightenment, man became his own God. Man became his own determiner of knowledge. Man became his own determiner of meaning. And everything was about the here and now. That's what it means by immanent. Here, now, this, what we can see and feel. And so if everything is about the here and now, if everything is about my happiness, if everything is about me as the individual, then difficulty and suffering and evil, that becomes more of a problem. Becomes more of a problem. And so essentially what you have is, if you remember those old scales where you balance them, you got more on one side than the other. Well, in older generations, before the Enlightenment, it was a heavily theologized era in which God was more prominent in explanations of everything. But then with the Enlightenment and the development of more secular philosophies, it became less about God and his transcendence and his glory and his will, and more about man and his will and his freedom and his individual happiness and his decision-making and his determining of what is important and meaningful in life. Well, as man becomes more important, then anything that happens to me becomes God's fault. That's where the problem of evil comes in. So people trying to reconcile, how can all this happen to me if there's a good God? Well, that comes in because of the immanent frame of how important I am and how distant and how removed and how unimportant God is. So atheism talks about this as being a problem, but really for most of the history of the world, it wasn't a problem. It only became a problem the more that we put ourselves in the focus and made ourselves bigger than God. A strong theological foundation is able to wrestle with and handle the presence of evil in a theocentric world. So I think one of the problems where we are now is that we had an elevation of man, an elevation of man's own opinion of himself and his own abilities and his own ability to reason and figure out things. And at the same time, a corresponding devaluing of God and a devaluing of theology. And as humanistic philosophy became studied and became more important, theology was studied less and less and became less important. And so even people like today in the 20th and 21st century who would claim to be Christians and have a theology, their theology is very shallow, isn't it? In a lot of respects. And their theology, their Christianity is still mixed with a very heavy dose of Enlightenment individualism. But if we were to go back to the scriptures and really study them in depth and try to wrestle with them, we would be able to come to a stronger theological foundation, wouldn't we? We would be able to go beyond the surface level theological claims or Christian arguments, and we can actually get into understanding what the scriptures teach and actually what teachers of the church have taught for the last 2,000 years. If we got deeper into what God says in his word, then we would have a really good foundation for handling difficulty and suffering in the world. And we wouldn't have to really wrestle with or the problem of evil with a good God, because we would understand how these things fit together in a bigger theological picture. Atheism also claims a better response to suffering because they advocate for solutions. That's what atheism, naturalism is all about. So suffering has no place. It's got no meaning. This serves no purpose. So let's get rid of it. So let's focus on solutions, right? Let's do social justice. Let's work for human flourishing. Let's find cures. Let's balance economic disparity. Let's do all these things that can help fix the problems. But there's two problems with these claims. One of the problems with their claims is that historically, issues of social justice have actually been championed more by religious movements than secular ones. I mean, just go back to even in recent memory. Why was slavery abolished in Britain? William Wilberforce, right? Christian arguments, biblical arguments against slavery. Even just a few decades ago, the civil rights movement was argued in religious terms. And so issues of social justice, historically over centuries, dealing with the poor, dealing with the diseased, dealing with economic oppression, all of this, a lot of it has been championed more by people of faith than by people who had just bare secular worldviews. So that's one problem with atheism's claims is historically, they really haven't been the champions of social justice and improvement like they claim. Another problem is that atheism's naturalistic foundation really offers no clear or rational basis for morality or justice. So the problem with naturalism is that they've got no clear rational basis for saying this is right, this is wrong. Science and empirical reason cannot be the basis of morality because they can tell us how people live, but not how they ought to live. So for example, anthropology. What does anthropology do? Anthropology studies how human civilizations have lived, either in the past or even in the present, anthropology. So they can make scientific observations based on evidence, whether it be archaeological or written historical evidence. They can make observations and present papers and present work on this is how this society lived. But all that is a report. It tells you what they did. It has no authority to say this is how you ought to live. It just reports this is how people lived. So a pure scientific worldview cannot give you any kind of authority on how you ought to live. Same thing with just an atheistic scientific worldview. If we all came from monkeys and monkeys steal bananas from one another, then why can't I steal from your house? I mean, that's naturalistic, right? And if it's just about the survival of the fittest, well, then the strongest should be able to do whatever he wants to do. And what moral law or moral truth can tell him no? So they've got no foundation. So how people live instead of how they ought to live, I think this also helps to explain some recent decisions by the Supreme Court. Because recent decisions by the Supreme Court, when you have no foundation for law or for morality, then what you end up doing wrongly, I think, is you end up telling people what they ought to do based on what people do. So just to give you an example, if you have no theistic morality, or if you have no philosophical morality, no firm foundation for what is right and wrong, or no firm foundation in the law as written, then what you're going to do is you're going to base your opinions based on the prevailing winds of the day, right? So you go back and you can even read this. You can pull this up. You can go to I think SCOTUS.org, Supreme Court of the United States, or maybe .gov, and you can read the opinions of the justices who sided on every issue. You can read exactly what they wrote, exactly the arguments that they made. And you go back and look at the majority opinion in the same-sex marriage case, and essentially for Kennedy, the swing vote, his everything came down to, well, this is where we are now. This is where we are now. This is where the opinion, the culture of America has moved to. But where is there any basis in law for that? And it really striking, especially when he was the one asking, should we overthrow millennia of historical precedent? Well, apparently the current opinion of the American people is more important than either law or millennia of historical precedent, because that's what he sided with. So if you've got no basis for morality or for law, no firm foundation, then you're just going to shift and change based on what's happening now. So one author, Michael Sandel, in a book asks, right now in our culture, we have a lot of different conflicting theories about justice and about how we should make law on important things such as abortion or immigration reform or same-sex marriage. And what he argues in his book is there is no neutral, rational basis for any of the sides on these issues. There's no such thing as a neutral, purely scientific, or purely rational basis for any of these views. So if that's the case, then you're going to end up arguing not from a scientific viewpoint, you're going to end up arguing from a viewpoint of worldview, or a viewpoint of faith, or a viewpoint of religion. So he says each side argues on the basis of different conceptions of freedom, different views of the proper relationship of the individual to the community, different definitions of a virtuous human life, and those come from your worldview. So atheism does not solve the big questions of what justice is and what our vision of the good society should be. It doesn't have the tools to be able to do it. So they can tell people how they live, but not how they ought to live. So then he asks, is it really a comfort then to the bereaved to tell them that death is the end of everything and that there is no suffering in death? How much consolation is there in that? He says, this is really too brutal to be honest. It makes little sense to point to a state in which we are stripped of all love and everything that gives meaning in life and tell people that they need not fear it. So if everything is about your personal happiness and enjoyment and freedom, well, guess what? According to the atheistic worldview, you're going to a place where you have no freedom, you have no happiness, you have nothing. Why should I not be concerned about that? The secular view of non-existence pales in comparison to the Christian doctrine of resurrection, doesn't it? I mean, if you're just to say, you know, you might have an atheist say, well, yeah, but I don't believe the resurrection. Well, yeah, well, I'm on this side and I don't believe in non-existence. So our faiths are in competition with each other. Let's just set those aside for a moment. Which would you rather have? Non-existence or forever with God in eternal bliss? One's better, isn't it? So how can atheism say we're better able to prepare people for death than Christianity? I don't see it. When you give me the hope of resurrection and a new heavens and a new earth and eternal joy in the kingdom of God, I'll take that over nothing any day. So he says, putting aside the question of which set of beliefs is true, because both sides can argue that the other side's beliefs are false, it's hard to maintain that the secular framework equips its followers as well for evil and suffering as religious faiths equip theirs. So when real life suffering comes, historical experience shows us that people find more consolation in religion and spirituality than in the secular view. Wouldn't you? I know I'm talking to Christians, so I've got a stacked audience here. But if we're just to compare, put two things side by side and say, I can't dogmatically prove Christianity and you can't dogmatically prove evolution. So you can't dogmatically prove what happens after death, and I can't dogmatically prove what happens after death. So let's just set our worldview side by side. Which one is better? Christianity prepares people better for suffering because there's more consolation in it. There's more encouragement in it. There's more hope in it.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah, go ahead.
So what is the general outlook of death from an atheist perspective?
I think it's that. I think it's just... Well, I think
life, it's here today and tomorrow it's not. And
yeah, I think it's kind of an Epicurean philosophy of eat, drink, have a party because tomorrow we die. So everything's about here and now. Everything's about what's happening in the moment because there really is no future beyond this. So, you know, make everything count for now. Bring me the most joy now that I can. I think that's the way a pure atheist would look at it, is if there's no meaning beyond this life, then I'm going to enjoy it the best that I can.
You mentioned earlier about times of tragedy and how people all of a sudden, you know, become religious.
Yeah.
So as to speak, but like in a combat setting.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that even atheists will want to have their right, you know, their last rites.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
much, you know, pain and anguish. And,
yeah. And honestly, it probably varies from person to person. You know, you might have someone who is an avowed atheist and he would refuse all that, you know, even in his last moments. But it's very possible that you would have someone who is an atheist, but who had maybe some Christian background, maybe some Christian in his upbringing. And that the moment of that would cause him to kind of default back to maybe what he really feels more deep down, that there is a God to whom I'm accountable.
I've heard more than one say they had never seen an atheist in a pot calling a firefight.
Yeah. And he brings out that quote in the chapter and he says, you know, there are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, difficulty brings people face to face with their worldview. This is no longer theoretical. You know, this is life or death now.
It goes back to that all about me perspective in general.
When
I can make a name for myself by standing for whatever it is, you know, whether it's prayer in school or you know, I can be known to be the person that stops something from happening that the consensus was in favor of, then are they really atheists, or are they just, you know, playing that particular hand in life?
Yeah. I think there are people who are genuinely atheistic in their worldview, and they genuinely don't believe in a God. At least in their mind, they would be committed to that view of life. Although, if you understand what Paul is arguing in Romans chapter 1, there really is no such thing as a true atheist, because every person knows by what's around him, what God has made, that there's a God. And in our own consciences, Romans 2 says that we have this testimony to even God's moral law. So, you know, I think people can argue for it. I think what you have in an atheist is you have somebody, what Paul says, suppressing the truth. So God has built into every human being, I believe, a knowledge of himself, a knowledge of God in his own soul, as well as in the created order around him, this instinctive knowledge that I have a creator, I have a God that I'm accountable to. But because of our inclination to serve self, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to become accountable to God. So I'm going to come up with reasons, rational reasons and philosophical reasons, that I can suppress the truth and satisfy my own thinking that there's not a God. And then I can live however I want. Because Paul says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Another way of saying that could be through their unrighteousness. So they hold down the truth. They suppress it. They don't want to think about the fact that there's a God who's their creator. And they live out their lives in unrighteousness, helping to cover that up, if you will, helping to suppress that. So I think mentally, philosophically, yes, there are true atheists. But deep down in their consciences, I think there's always a battle there with what God has built into them and around them in creation. Yeah, and that's he gets into that a little bit later on in the lesson. Is one of the problems with the atheistic worldview is it promises too much. It promises happiness, it promises my own personal freedom, and it promises, okay, in our atheistic worldview, suffering has no place, so our solution is let's get rid of it as much as possible. Let's cure cancer. Let's solve economic imbalance. Let's do social justice. Let's do everything that we can to make our world better. Well, the problem is we've been trying that for thousands of years, right? And it's still not very good. So the problem is that in our human condition, we're never going to be able to get there. The vast majority of people still have unhappy lives and difficult lives. And how miserable of a condition is that if your primary goal in life is to find happiness and you never find it? That's a miserable existence, isn't it? And yet a lot of people in our generation are setting themselves up for that disappointment. And they're chasing after happiness in all the wrong places and they're not finding it. And that's why we have a lot of psychological ailments today, I think, because of that. We're looking for happiness in the wrong places. And so I think we have, deep down, we have an intuition. We have a knowledge that we're not just a bunch of chemicals. We're not just a bunch of substances gathered together, but we have a soul. We have a soul. And I think that's one of the most widespread convictions of human beings in the world today and throughout all ages. And he just points out in the book that every family in Newtown, Connecticut had a religious funeral that lost a child. They all offered prayers. And so people have a heightened and obvious sense of morality and justice in the face of great evil. I think when you're confronted with a child who has died lying in a casket, you can't imagine for yourself non-existence, never seeing that person again. And it's hard for us to really, truly believe that in those moments. And I think it's then when we kind of tend to fall back on maybe what's deeper in our souls, and that is that there's not just a physical part of us, there's a spiritual part of us. And we tend to fall back on that. This is probably a good time to stop because there's another section coming, and I don't want to keep you till 7:30. So any thoughts or any questions before we go tonight? I mean, the only thing that I can possibly imagine, if you're from a purely scientific, you know, naturalistic viewpoint, that I think they would have to, at least to be consistent, they would have to say, well, it's a glitch in their chemical makeup, or it's a, you know, this person that went out and did this unthinkable evil, it was a malfunction in their cells or in their chemicals or something. I don't know how else they would explain it, you know, because for them, the mind is just a blob of tissue and chemicals and neurons. And so you might have, I don't know how else they would explain it other than one of the neurons misfired, you know, and they did this. But here's the problem is the purely evolutionary naturalistic worldview is unlivable. It's unlivable. And there's not a person in the world, there's not a government, there's not a culture in the world that would actually want to live out to its logical conclusion its naturalistic worldview. We all fall back on, and this is one of the apologetic arguments for Christianity, is that every culture automatically falls back on some elements of Christian foundation, all the while they're denying it. So we have laws against murder. Why? There's no logical, rational place for it in an evolutionary viewpoint, is there? So they don't live consistently in their philosophical thinking. So they'll argue for atheism, they'll argue for naturalism, but when it really comes to real life, there are times when they've got to fall back on some elements of the Christian worldview for the world to even be a livable place. Because if you just dropped all boundaries and all laws, nobody would want to live in that, would you? So that's one of the arguments to make, is that really you're inconsistent with your philosophies. You like to argue against God because you want to do what you want to do. But when it comes to people stealing your stuff or hurting you, then you want law and you want justice and you want morality. That's a really good point, is they don't really have a good explanation for moral evil, especially heinous evil like the Holocaust, like you mentioned, or something like that. Well, thank you all for listening, for coming, for your questions and your comments. I hope this is helpful to you. And bring your papers back next week. Bring your pens back next week. And we'll pick up where we left off. Let's have a word of prayer. Lord, thank you for your love for us. Thank you for the truth of your word. Thank you for the hope that we have in Christ, that this life is not all there is, that we don't just have to set our eyes on earthly things, but that we can look to that which is heavenly. We can look to that which is eternal, and we can have the hope of an eternal inheritance that's laid up in heaven for us. Lord, help us as your people to put our confidence, our hope in you. And Lord, help us to spread that joy and that hope to others around us. And we pray this in Christ's name. Amen.